Should start with some apologies and disclaimers. I'm, after a long break, coming back to this program, which is rather well, also philosophical program of understanding quantum theory in terms of unsharp reality. So I'm picking up things that I left many years ago. At the same time, I'm acutely aware that I'm only superficially familiar with a lot of the technical work on the quantum classical connections and all the aspects that go with it. So my talk will be rather sketchy in many respects, and I'm sure at the end of the conference I'm going to rewrite it, and it may look quite different in the light of what I'm learning here. So, well, here's how I go about it. I want to spend some time on what I regard as the problem of the quantum classical contrast. And having done that, look at two lines of technical developments. And again, very, very sketchy. One being the problem of, well, establishing classical descriptions of quantum systems. Some call that the hidden variable problem approach, but there is more to it, I believe, or different other interpretations to that. And the other being the question of quantum descriptions for classical systems that addresses the classical limit problem. So as I said, this is not a systematic account or even solution to any of those problems. And it's a rather patchy picture of where I think we are. And that's certainly a very time-dependent statement, as I tried to point out. And I'll just make some pointers as to where this might be going. I highlight a few things that I think may not have received sufficient attention in the current approach that I'm aware of. So particularly my theme will be to elucidate the role of unsharpness in the various lines I'm following through here. Let me start with my favorite quote of Niels Bohr that captures quite a lot of the problematics of our conference, I believe. In the language of the relativity theory, Bohr says in his Como lecture, 1927, published in 1928, the content of the relations to, which are the uncertainty relations, may be summarized in the statement that according to the quantum theory, a general reciprocal relation exists between the maximum sharpness of definition of the space-time and energy-momentum vectors associated with the individuals. This circumstance may be regarded as a simple symbolical expression for the complementary nature of the space-time description and claims of causality. At the same time, however, the general character of this relation makes it possible to a certain extent to reconcile the conservation laws with the space-time coordination of observations. The idea of a coincidence of well-defined events in the space-time point being replaced by that of unsharply defined individuals within finite space-time regions. Needless to say that the colorings are mine, but I would like to take Bohr as my witness that, as Jim Hartle accused me once of having introduced this Teutonic word, unsharp, into the English language, that wasn't me, as you see here. But I'm pretty happy to use it. And this statement of Bohr's captures, in a nutshell, his notion of complementarity. And, well, this is, I take it to be Bohr's way of expressing this clash between the quantum and the classical descriptions. Bohr says here that in the classical description we had space-time coordination, which he identifies with observation, going together consistently with causal descriptions, which he also identifies as the assignment of states to isolated objects. And he says this was an idealization that worked in classical physics, whereas in quantum physics we learned the hard way that these two things do not consistently, or fully at least, go together. When we observe, we interact. If we try to define a system and its state, then we need to make sure that it lives in its own world, uncoupled to the rest. And he has complementarity is probably best described as a dialectical way of going about this problem. But his reconciliation that he suggests here is very much, as I see it, in the direction of some sort of notion of unsharp reality. So that's basically perhaps a description also of my program. So, what is this problem of the quantum classical contrast? Well, I think it's a dilemma for some, and certainly a tension for all of us, or it should be, between two things. One is the statement that quantum theory is seen to supersede and contradict classical physical theory. It supersedes, well, the whole reason for quantum mechanics being there is that classical physics failed to account for certain phenomena in the physical world. It contradicts classical physical theory. This has been highlighted in the hidden variables problem and pretty much explicitly formalized in things like the Cochin spectra and the Bell theorems. So we have that on one hand, and on the other hand, we have that statement that quantum measurement requires classical apparatus. Here I name the measurement problem as the problem of accounting within quantum mechanics for the transition from indeterminate values to definite measurement outcomes. At the same time, I'd like to highlight here the fact that concrete quantum mechanics, with its given, non-relativistic particle, with its specific sets of observables, builds on classical Galilean space-time symmetries and so on for its definition. I expect we hear more about this problem or issue in at least one other talk on this workshop. So, how does one go about reconciling these two things or getting rid of one in favor of the other? So there are obviously then probably those three logical options: deny one or the other or both. The first point of view is taking quantum mechanics as the fundamental universal framework. We heard it yesterday. We live in a quantum world, if we believe it. But in order to deal with that clash, with that dilemma, one has to add some fancy interpretation. I'll say a bit more on the next sheet what that is about. So we have A but not B in this way. Or, well, one could take... I wish I had a... We could take priority, place priority on B and deny A. That amounts to admitting that there is a pluralism of theories or a network of theories of equal validity in their own domains. Or finally, we might call for a modification of quantum mechanics to get rid of this clash. All three paths have been pursued, and I'll say briefly a bit about each of them to just make more specific what they are and how they relate to each other. Each of those ways of going about this quantum classical contrast has to face up at some point to the question, where is that quantum classical border? So if we have, for instance, the middle point of view, a theory pluralism, then how do we decide which is the natural domain of each theory? We go from the very small, where we believe quantum mechanics is correct, to larger and larger systems. Where does quantum mechanics cease to be correct? Along the same lines, pretty much along the same lines, there's the measurement problem I already mentioned. So an account of that would have to be given in one way or another. I describe it here again in Shimoni's words as the actualization of potentialities. I'm getting a bit more technical and concrete towards the end to put some flesh to the ideas and notions. So bear with me for the time being. So the first position is claiming the universality of quantum mechanics, according to the slogan, we live in a quantum world. And here's a list of approaches or interpretational stances to try to make sense of that. There's many worlds, many minds, or various relational interpretations. There is the hidden variables approach, exemplified by Bohmian quantum mechanics. There are various types of consistent history formulations that belong here, or other non-collapse interpretations that went by the name of model interpretations, mostly in the 1980s to 90s, when they were developed. And I'd finally also bring up here the epistemic probability interpretation, and a little further, going further than that, perhaps the instrumentalistic interpretation of quantum mechanics, which would be compatible with some worldview that's more realistic, but quantum mechanics in itself is just the instrument to deal with the description of experiments and nothing more. Well, most of these are actually neatly summarized, characterized by the Boop Clifton uniqueness theorem. I'm just only giving this as a pointer to you, the theorem, as well as the book by Jeffrey Boop. I recommend it strongly. The theorem roughly goes like this. It says each of those interpretations can be characterized by a different set of preferred observables, which are declared to be real, definite values, given a particular state, that is. So together with the state and that observable, one can then have one then has an algorithm to determine the maximal possible set according to certain rules of properties that can be considered as definite. This amounts to weakening realism compared to the usual von Neumann projection postulate rule, by which real is what is not in an eigenstate, what's represented by an eigenstate of an observable. So it's breaking the so-called, the slogan is breaking the eigenstate eigenvalue link that leads to weaker conditions of reality, but thereby more quantities that are actually real. And Boop shows very nicely in his book that at least the four top lines are fitting neatly into that theorem. So what we take away here is that fancy interpretation means being prepared to live with a weaker notion of reality. And maybe that is what quantum mechanics and the experience with quantum physics is telling us. I leave that open for now. The theory network proposition. Well, here I want to quote Ludwig. Well, actually, Ludwig, as he sees Bohr and as he sees himself, fulfill the Bohrian program. Here's what he says in 1987, which is basically, well, the last but one book that he published. There's just one book that came out. One of Ludwig's books was just published in 2 years ago in English for the first time, which takes sort of the really bird's eye perspective on theory construction in physics. But this is the last technical summary of this work. Before further discussions, let us again expound this sharply. The author's opinion is that the notion of quantum mechanics as the most comprehensive theory is wrong. The axiomatic basis presented in this book reflects precisely the conception and the idea espoused at the beginning of quantum mechanics with an astoundingly clear intuitive view by Niels Bohr. The axiomatic basis does not allow us to regard the objectivating description of macroscopic systems as some approximation to quantum mechanics. And in line with that claim, Ludwig arrives at the conclusion that classical theories, classical mechanics, all macro theories, classical field theories, they are pre-theories to quantum mechanics, which doesn't make them logically dominant, but they are necessary in that, have a necessary place in that network of theories that, we build up when doing physics. So then his remaining concern is to show that those macroscopic theories are actually compatible with quantum theory. And the way he goes about that is by looking at consistent embeddings of those macro theories into an extrapolated many-body quantum theory. He does all this at a level more abstract than usual Hilbert space quantum mechanics. He takes into account the operational structure that we got a glance at yesterday, but in its full-fledged richness, allowing for infinite systems and so on. And basically, his conclusion after, well, decades of attempts is that that embedding of macro theories into quantum theory can only be approximate. He gives examples of that, rather simple examples, such as the quantum mechanical description of a macroscopic of a large particle. I come back to that a little later. But one can still say the program is well alive, and that's documented in this review paper by Lanz, Facchini, and Melsheimer, which appeared in the Girardi Festschrift just recently. Well, yeah?
On the previous page, Ludwig, your quote is saying the embedding can only be approximate.
That's not a theorem, it's a practical conclusion.
Does he give examples of systems that seem very difficult to embed in any non-approximate way?
Well, what I mean by approximate is, or he means by approximate, is in particular that he has to use the full structure of observables, including PUVMs, to represent macroscopic observables. And we'll see an example of that that he more or less develops himself as well.
Oh, may I also ask you this? How would this problem of quantum stability matter? Yeah, I mean, since the theory which explains stability matter, and if we go to classical mechanics and we treat our measuring instruments according to that theory, then probably they are not stable.
I think, well, if I'm, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think these theorems proving the stability of matter, they draw on the full formalism of systems with infinitely many degrees of freedom.
Not only.
Well, then I'm not sure how to answer that. I have to postpone that discussion. Just as a reminder, what Ludwig is not up to then, for him, as far as I understand him, the criterion for recovering macroscopic dynamics comes from the macro theory, which carries with it then some notion of relevant observables which evolved according to deterministic laws so that they display definite values all the time. So again, the embedding of the macro theory into quantum mechanics is only meant to demonstrate consistency. It's not meant to be, well, Ludwig gave up on the claim, at least, that this would be a derivation of the former through the latter. The third line of approach goes a little further than that. It says that maybe quantum mechanics, as well as those macro theories, they are not the last word, and one has to do some more. And these are the spontaneous collapse and reduction models, gravity-induced collapse conjecture, and I believe some of the history's extensions of quantum theory belong here too, at least if I take seriously the words of some proponents such as Griffiths and maybe Raphael Sorkin. I'd love to discuss this further. I think the aim here is to maintain a strong version of realism and universality of whatever theory comes of that. So rejecting the pluralism idea, whilst allowing for this new message of quantum physics that there is a new modality between actuality and absence of properties, negation of actuality. There is potentiality, indefiniteness of values. For those of you who are still here on Thursday afternoon, Angelo Bassi is giving a seminar on this line of approach. Well, as far as I can tell, the game is wide open, at least in the sense that, well, we have these interpretational stances, we have people defending them, people discussing between the different groups of approaches, and nobody being able to convince the other to reach a consensus. So at least in that sense, the game is wide open. And where should we take it? Well, my take is to look at structural conceptual issues here, and in particular, as I said, have a look at the role of unsharpness in all this. Well, here is quantumness versus classicality, or in the light of yesterday's discussion, I should perhaps be more careful and say, well, just a description of some features of non-classicality represented by quantum mechanics, but that's good enough for me for the moment. And these are on the operational side, the fact that measurements disturb, and that goes with the statement that there is a limit to joint measurability of certain pairs of quantities in quantum physics, which is loosely, well, more or less tightly actually linked with the non-commutativity of pairs of sets of observables, of the set of observables. And there is, yeah, again, the non-definiteness of values, which is generic in quantum states, and that goes with the superposition of eigenstates. The point was raised already earlier yesterday that logically it's not so easy within a given framework to separate these properties. In order to identify the logical relation or independence between such features, one has to go to a more general theory framework in which these features are not already built in. Such work has been done already in the 1970s to 80s in the framework of the operational approach and quantum logic. And there have been, well, there are models which, for instance, incorporate uncertainty relations, but not, say, complementarity as one of the ways of describing the impossibility of joint measurements, an extreme way of having non-joint measurability, or models that incorporate complementarity but may not have an uncertainty relation. So such investigations can be done, have been done, and there's therefore an awareness that this association between operational and formal is rather loose if we play it out in quantum mechanics, but at least some of these properties on the formal side are sufficient to make those operational properties theorems in that particular theory. And then the question is, how can we get past those limitations? Because obviously these are limitations that we don't know in classical theories. So that concludes the first part, and I'm going into my structural investigations. The aim of this section, classical description of a quantum system, is to give you a uniqueness theorem which says roughly there is essentially only one good classical representation of a quantum probabilistic theory. And if we look at that, then perhaps we learn again something about quantum mechanics and its contrast with classical theories. I take the operational point of view. And that is, I draw on the, well, what I like to call, I've come accustomed to call the statistical models or dualities approach, call it operational approach, convexity approach, whatever you grew up with or got used to. But the structure is well established. We have a convex set of states embeddable into a vector space. And because we want to use that to represent probabilities for experimental outcomes, what goes with it naturally is a set of fine functionals which assign these probabilities, and that is a set of effects. There's somewhat more to say. One can get, and one has to focus, one has to say something about topological properties. It's not very far-fetched to get to the statement that the embedding vector spaces are Banach spaces with respect to natural norm topologies, which is, well, in quantum mechanics, the trace norm topology is known as the Bayes norm topology in this state space. And there is the set of effects is embedded in what is called an order unit space, which again carries with it an order unit interval, which defines the unit ball of a norm. So these are dual structures which fall into our lap if we reflect on the representation of experimental statistics. So I leave all the technical details out that are behind this. This is just the bare bones. And here are our classical and quantum realizations of that. The classical set of states is, well, I should perhaps say in the most general setting is a simplex of simplex structure. Well, I make it concrete. I have a value space, an outcome space, and or a phase space, and a sigma algebra of subsets. In that, I take the measures, positive elements, and then I have a normalization to one. These are my classical states, probability measures on phase space. The classical set of effects is the set of all measurable functions into the 0-1 interval. This is more than the 0-1 valued functions, which would be the crisp effects. This is generally the definition of fuzzy subsets of omega. And then the duality gets closed by this natural relation which defines our probabilities for an event represented by the effect F given by the usual integration expression. This is a very rough and vague formulation of a theorem that one can get out of the convexity approach, which basically amounts to saying that the compatibility of all sharp effects leads to such a classical representation coming from a general convexity frame, plus further general axioms that single out properties of this set of extreme effects, which are the classical properties, are to be the classical properties. The quantum statistical model or convexity model is given in the usual way by the density operators and the quantum effects. That goes very quickly. You all know that formula that closes the duality. And here I'd like to highlight a result of my friends, Bugajski and Lahti from 1985. Using the convexity framework, combining it with the axioms of quantum logic to a certain point as they can be physically justified, this combination plus an incorporation of an axiom of ideal measurements, the existence of ideal measurements, plus a specific way of formalizing the existence of observables that are incompatible in a strong sense called complementarity. These ideas lead to a realization of the Hilbert space model. So that's one neat way of getting, well, roughly speaking, getting quantum mechanics out of the complementarity postulate. I think the related approach is taken by Schwinger in his work on what he calls measurement algebra. He takes for complementarity the fact, well, he makes a finite dimensional approach. He takes for complementarity the fact that there are these mutually unbiased bases, which says that there are pairs of bases which are such that if I take one eigenvector of one set of bases, one vector, then in that vector, in each of those vectors, all the other vectors of the other bases have the same modulus of amplitude. So express that in terms of observables, then you say if one observable is definite, the other observable is completely uncertain with uniform distributions of values, and vice versa. So that is Schwinger's approach, which is very much similar in spirit to this. So these are our quantum and classical statistical models.
Oh,
and
can I?
Yeah?
Just in the previous slide, going back.
Oops, I went in the wrong direction, sorry.
It seems to me that these classical, the formulation of classical physics is can't possibly be unique in that it is modular quantum. The objects and the operations have been separated out, which is usually not how one does classical. You do quantum mechanics that take up space and operations, objects somehow separated from operations. In classical mechanics, you have dimensional variables, there are objects which you can then measure. So, in doing this, probably you're just practically doing operational approach. In the end, you want to talk about unsharpness, which is an ontological. Maybe you do.
Well, I'm effectively throwing that away here by including and paying attention to the set of sharp properties, which are your basically your functions in phase space and their classical spectral resolutions. So that's included. And if I just focus on that and require compatibility of all those, then that leaves me with the classical structure. Mm-hmm. So there is an operational way of getting the general features of classical theory.
But also the fact that even in classical theory, one is talking about, you have dynamical variables, but you observe these dynamical variables in certain states. You always observe them in states. So the concept of states and observables is present in classical mechanics.
Yes.
So he said that when one learns classical mechanics, this is not exactly how it's presented, but it's what is there.
I mean, just
well, maybe that remark helps. The set of omega is represented in this probability set of probability measures by the delta measures,
yeah.
The Dirac measures. So you recover that as an idealization, of course. But it's there, if not operationally accessible. So there are idealizations that you make to come to your usual formulation of classical mechanics.
So I just have one other question related to this. There is also an algebraic framework for arriving at this. My question is, do you think they're equivalent, or is one containing the other? Or not?
Well, I think as far as I can tell, the algebraic frameworks, algebraic quantum theories or physical theories, they always incorporate also a convex structure, convex duality, but not the other way around. So in principle, it takes further steps to bring in or bring out of the convexity model, bring out algebraic structures. And I hope we learn more about that in Mauro's talk. So, here we have the classical and the quantum statistical models, and there is a question, how can we meaningfully relate them to each other? One way of approaching that is by way of what I would call classical embedding of a quantum theory. So I'm embedding the quantum states into a set of classical states by way of an affine mapping that respects the natural convex structure that I require for probabilities in experiments. That gives rise to a dual mapping which goes backwards. This is irritating. I was wondering where that fly was coming from. Not a fly on the wall. Which is, well, bear in mind these structures are embedded naturally into vector spaces, so you can also view them as linear maps. So there's a linear structure here in this association. And typically, well, this would be an instance of what is often called a quantization map. If one regards, well, not the transition from classical effects to quantum effects, but rather classical observables to quantum observables, then one would call this a quantization map. So this way of looking at the relationship between classical and quantum is basically the quantization point of view. What we want in it is a coverage of all quantum effects. We have already taken care that all quantum states are taken care of here, so that is done. But we want coverage of all quantum effects. So what do we need for that? Well, we need that phi is injective. And that is to say that phi is induced by an informationally complete observable. So that's the structure. There's an observable on some sigma algebra of values into the quantum effects, which induces a map from the quantum states to probability measures on omega. And these are given by the usual trace formulas here, or they can be written in a classical form, which defines the dual map then. So that's the structure induced by informationally complete observables, and we are more or less forced to take in order to have certain, we would like to have surjectivity of the map phi dash. That forces us to have injectivity, but then if we go follow this through, what we find is phi dash maybe must be surjective as a linear map from the space of all classical observables into the quantum self-adjoint operators, but it is not surjective as a map between the sets of effects. The next take would be to say, the surjectivity as a linear map ensures that every quantum effect can be approximated by classical observables. But again, that runs out of the positivity cone on the classical side. So this representation of quantum mechanics can only be regarded as partial. It works for the characteristic functions on omega and whatever combinations we can build out of those, which leads to basically the effects in the range of our original observable, which we use to construct this mapping, this embedding. Yeah?
I hope you'll forgive me for a moment. I'm just trying to make sure that I understand what's going on. So essentially, this classical embedding, this map from quantum states to classical states and from classical observables to quantum observables, you're defining a symbol here. essentially, right? Like the bigger function?
Like?
So, toy case, if I have a d-dimensional quantum system, a d-dimensional Hilbert space, then this would be a mapping to a classical probability simplex with at least d squared outcomes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then, and then phi prime is the dual map on observables, which takes me from the symbol to the quantum corresponding. So it takes me from d squared dimensional classical simplices to quantum. But, right, what's confusing is that's not what I would usually think of as quantization. Quantization is usually something where I start with a classical system with d distinct states, and I end up with a d-dimensional Hilbert space. But this map from classical observables to quantum observables takes me from a d-squared dimensional classical space to a d-dimensional quantum space. Can you resolve my confusion? What do I have wrong?
Well, I think the matching of dimensions is a tricky business in this. Well, I think I can't do it sort of out of my head right now, but I only wanted to point out this as well, the analogy. If we take this set of classical observables of some classical system, and we get the quantum version of that system by doing that, and I'm not too familiar right now with how one would do that for a quantum spin system. That's what you're basically asking.
Perhaps a bit would be, quantum information.
Yeah. Well, a classical bit would not sort of quantize easily. That's too small.
In this sense, it wouldn't. But normally, we would talk about taking a classical bit and quantizing it, and we would get a qubit, right? A two-dimensional quantum system. And it seems that in this case, you would have to start with at least a four-dimensional quantum system, or a classical system, I'm sorry, to quantize it into a qubit. Is that accurate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I realize I should have avoided that word, because that was just a...
Okay, sorry.
but you were asking this question, what's going on here with this partial nature of the representation is seen in the qubit case. You have a set of states represented by the Poincaré or Bloch sphere, and that would be your associated set of quantum effects. Here we have an association into, as you say, a simplex like that. So that you find your ellipsoid image of the quantum states in there. That's going that way, and what is the associated thing here? Well, take your associated classical set of effects and embed it affinely into this here, and I can't draw this very quickly, but you get the idea. It's somehow an image of this thing which has to necessarily, it's a linear structure, polyhedral structure, which lies inside the set of effects. That is ensured. But because it lies inside and has this straight linear structure, it is quite easy to see that it cannot hit most of at least the projections, for instance. So that's an intuitive way of seeing what's going wrong here. And I mention here the Wigner function because that has a related, similar problem. We come to that a little later.
Well, I said that, but actually it's important to emphasize that none of this AX is projective.
Oh yes, of course, yeah. Well, yes, we have a theorem which says that informationally complete observables never have non-trivial projections in them. Non-trivial meaning not zero or one. That doesn't have to be included, of course. Yeah. So this is a very partial representation. It doesn't allow us even to approximate projections by positive classical functions, by classical effects. You end up bringing negative elements into it, and then your operational interpretation is blown up, is gone. The other way of doing it turns out to do the job, whatever the job is. In any case, I call it a classical extension. Well, it is called a classical extension. And it goes this way. We have, because it's meant to be an extension of quantum mechanics into a classical theory, what we start with is, yeah, just mapping the other way around, having a reduction map from classical states to the quantum states. We want to cover all quantum states, so we require that that mapping is surjective. That again entails that the dual mapping from the quantum effects to the classical effects is to be injective. And a solution is given by what we like to call the Misra-Bugaisky map. Misra was certainly one of the first to consider it, and consider it carefully also mathematically, in the 1970s. Bugaisky and then other people, along with him, Trametti and others, in the 1990s, rediscovered this in considering models, well, realizations of statistical models and the relationships then of classical statistical models with quantum models. And they really explored all the nice mathematical and conceptual properties of this mapping. The realization is goes like that. Take for omega the subset of pure states of the quantum states. And yeah, that would then be your classical state space, the classical probability measures. The mapping carries mu into, well, mu here represented in terms of delta measures, into psi mu, which is an average over mu of all the pure states. Omega stands for a pure state now. And that we can call rho sub mu, it's a density operator. The association of the quantum probabilities and representation as classical probabilities leads us naturally to the dual mapping, which sends quantum effects to classical effects in a unique way. So this is an injective association. Each quantum effect now does have a classical effect to it. Each quantum state does have at least one classical state to it. So here we are done. We have preserved the convex structures, we have respected those, and we have comprehensive coverage of all quantum states and quantum effects. So why isn't that a hidden variables theory? Well, perhaps it is. It may be called by some who like to go down that route. But what price do we pay? Well, in light of Rob's paper yesterday, he has pointed it out in his papers on the subject, on the paper on contextuality. Well, there are two things to mention. One is the many-to-one nature of the mapping, SC to SQ. Actually, mu can be taken for each quantum state rho. We can allow every mu that corresponds to any of the convex combinations, convex decompositions of rho. So every convex decomposition of rho, which is a way of preparing rho, is in the inverse image of this mapping, which is a way of saying that non-contextuality is broken. So this certainly can only be a non-contextual classical model of quantum mechanics. The other observation is that this classical function, which represents a quantum effect, is always a fuzzy classical effect. It's never a crisp classical effect. These functions, as we all know, Fe of omega, are never just 0, 1 value, but always continuous between 0 and 1. So on top of contextuality, we also necessarily have the non-deterministic nature of this hidden variables model. So my claim is that this is essentially unique as a non-redundant solution, and that would sort of make this interpretation inevitable. And here is the precise statement of that. Any reduction map, psi, starting with some phase omega, with the property that it's non-redundant, that is, the pure quantum states are just given as the images of the pure classical states. K can be represented according to the formula we have already seen. The quantum probability for an effect is given by the expectation of that associated classical function against a suitable probability measure, where the I function here comes about by way of identifying our phase space with the pure quantum states. And the hard work goes into proving all the right measure theoretic properties to make this statement mathematically meaningful. But the conclusion stands, as with the Mistra-Fugalsky map, where we chose omega immediately to be just pure quantum states, quantum effects are always fuzzy classical effects, never sharp. So that's then one way of phrasing this. If one insists in describing quantum mechanics in classical terms, and if one insists in doing this in a non-redundant way, then one is led to the conclusion that, yeah, quantum effects from the perspective of a classical physical theory are really intrinsically unsharp properties.
It's probably a trivial question. I just want to make sure I have the right idea. So to each distinct quantum pure state, there is also a distinct classical state?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, interesting point of clarification. I've often thought of that model as the Beltrametti-Fugalsky model. Am I crediting wrongly?
No, I would find that fair. I should have been fair to add that. It's probably not even possible to document it by the literature that it's down to Slavic, but it was basically my impression in discussions with him that the ideas originally came from him, but all the work seems to be joint work between them. So yeah, I take that point. I should be positivistic here. And
upon one other question, is this
give the credit.
Equivalence relations over here, that certain sets of maps going this way would be considered equivalent if I'm thinking of it for the following reason. Yeah, I have a very simple example in mind. You take standard phase space, R2, okay, Q and P. And so this is your classical phase space. Your point is the classical states are just delta measures concentrated at QP, okay? And you map that to the corresponding coherent state in QP, the standard coherent state. That, I suppose, will give you an example of this mapping. But there's more than one such map that you can do, which in some sense are all equivalent. So is there some equivalence condition over here?
Well, here I do this onto all quantum states. What you say is certainly not onto all pure quantum states. They are more selected. I suspect what you do is more in the spirit of the previous approach, classical embedding.
Yeah, that's okay. Is this map unique?
Which one?
Yes.
Well, modulo, if I have that constraint given some omega, then that implicitly selects certain sets omega for which one can do that.
Is it possible to make a one-to-one mapping from R2 phase space onto the pure states of a quantum system? I mean, one set is closed, the other is not.
Depends on your topology. Because in the quantum set, well, okay, finite dimensional systems. I don't know.
Well, if it's a finite-dimensional system, then it's a complex hypersphere, and that's closed, whereas the plane is not. If I take an infinite-dimensional system, then it seems to me that, I mean, I'm not sure exactly how to think of it, but the set of pure states for an infinite-dimensional system seems like it would be much, much, much larger than R2.
Yeah, and this is only maps to a subset of that in which...
Well, but I think Paul was saying he wants to map every quantum, to every quantum state. So I can take the block sphere and puncture it at one pole and then conformally unroll it on the plane, but I'd still be missing a single, right? Nothing would map to the down state, for instance. Is this a problem, or?
I don't know whether it fits into this theorem. It needs to be really explored. What cases of sort of non-trivial omegas one can choose. So far, we are aware of one choice, which is the one by Misra, Beltran, and Bugansky.
Oh, okay. So it's sufficient to consider omegas that can be mapped to quantum states.
I think that's what that says. Yeah, if I can do that, then this thing works. So that's part two, and I have 3-4 minutes for part three, or however much time I
have. Oh yeah, you still have
chairman allows me
at least another 5 minutes. But then you know, like we can go on until 1 o'clock.
After all, reality is fuzzy.
Yeah, reality is fuzzy. No, I mean another 10-15 minutes, and then we can continue the discussion. Mm-hmm. Because it's only about, it's not yet 12:30.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'll be done by one.
Yeah.
So. Well, let's look at this problem of what is involved when we try to approach a quantum description of a classical system. What I do here is a rather more hands-on approach than the more abstract approach that I just carried through or sketched out in the other section. The message that I'm working towards here is that bringing in unsharpness helps to restore some classicality, but it doesn't go all the way. So I'm looking at the counterparts to my quantum or non-classicality features, which are, well, at least approximate joint measurability and with a non-invasive measurability, and that goes also with the question of definite values. As for joint measurability, here's my PET example, PET model, and it's also one that, as I said, Ludwig looked at, and others following Ludwig. What does it take? That's the question. What does it take to model in quantum mechanics the classical behavior of a classical particle? So what we would want to see is a particle equipped with usual observables of position and momentum, and these in a classical particle, we regard these as being jointly measurable. So what can one do to reflect or represent this feature in quantum terms? Well, quantum mechanically, we have just our usual position and momentum observables, which are very strongly non-commutative. And to move towards the classical behavior, a minimal operational requirement is joint observability of those quantities, well, of those quantities that we are interested in, the position and momentum of that particle that we want to describe. So what we require is the existence of a POVM that represents the joint measurement probabilities. Well, let me run briefly through the history of that sort of problem. It was noted simultaneously by von Neumann and Wigner. Von Neumann has a theorem in his book which states the equivalence of joint measurability of observables, these are sharp observables, and their commutativity. For the problem of reconciling approximations to position and momentum, he goes to find phase space lattice of, well, something like coherent states, or a set of projections labeled with phase space labels, which make up then something like a discretized joint observable for, well, whatever it is, some discretized version of approximate position and approximate momentum. That's a very rigid approach, as the lattice suggests. It loses the nice continuity and covariance properties that we are familiar with for position and momentum in the classical as well as the quantum case. Wigner took a different approach. He requires these operators have to have g of x, y, g to have marginals which coincide with the spectral projections of position and momentum, respectively. This is actually an anachronistic way of formulating it, but comes to the same result. So I'm putting mathematics into Wigner's mouth, which he didn't use in exactly that form, but it amounts to that. So what Wigner finds is the Wigner function, and that is to say his operators g of x, y are not positive operators. All his probabilities are not probabilities, but quasi-probabilities, so they're not probabilities, full stop. But everybody still talks about quasi-probabilities. Already 1939, Husini discovers, before the discovery of phase-space observables, he discovers phase-space observables. Well, before the discovery of PODMs, he discovers phase-space observables. Again, this is anachronistically formulated. He finds coherent state-based probability distributions, which go like this, Q and P mapped to, well, for each row, let me put it again anachronistically, row eta Q P, eta Q P. And these are coherent states. And he realizes that that is a positive, well, perhaps I should give some normalization here. This is a positive probability normalized distribution on phase space. What it entails, we'll see in a moment. So this is what has been widely accepted now as the right track. But it's obvious that he must be giving up this association between sharp position and sharp momentum and the phase space observable underlying it.
I suppose this was based on the observation that if you average the Wigner function over small regions, then you got something which was positive. And that led to this.
I think that's a natural way of getting to this. Well,
it is also another problem related to what you said, that in order to get expectations of a function P and Q in terms of A and A naga, if they are not normally ordered, but they are series, you can have a situation in which you don't have convergence. Mm-hmm. In the sense that every normally ordered as an expectation is a function, but if it's not normally ordered, then you may have a situation in which, for example, if you take the expectation of an external product. But if you want to make tomography in this way, it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Because the expectation of a rank one projector, for example, is not convergent, corresponding to a distribution. So, because you want to write expectation as probability expectation, where this Q function is the probability, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there is not a corresponding well-behaved function for example, for rank one projector. It suffers from a problem.
Is this an objection or a comment?
I'm saying this doesn't work.
Doesn't work for what?
For some observables.
For one particular perspective that you can take on quantum tomography, yeah. But it's perfectly good, I would maintain, for quantum state determination. This thing is an informationally complete observable. So you get all the information on the states that you would like to. Whether you want to use this to reconstruct observables, that is a different question. And I don't know whether why one should go that route. There may be reasons which I'm not aware of, but
right.
But from the conceptual operational point of view, this is going in the right direction because this is, again respects the convexity structure and the probability structure, therefore. So here is a quick run over what has been achieved going down the line of constructing phase-space observables. The requirements for constructing these is that G should be a PODM on phase space. Here I'm looking at a particle in one dimension. This PLM should respect the characteristic covariance properties of position and momentum, and these are the representing the Weyl, Heisenberg Weyl operators, phase-phase shifts represented in terms of unitaries, and one should have this covariance relation. And as we know today, there is a unique class of solutions which all have this form, G, labeled by T, which is something like a state operator, density operator, called a positive operator of phase one. Of Z, phase cell Z, is one of the 2 pi h bar, the integral of this phase translated version of T. There's a long development that led to making this uniqueness statement at least precise, and that leads up to, well, firming up technical things to these recent works of Cassinelli et al. And our present friends, Yuka, Kiyokas, and Pekalati. So that is a long line of development and has this unique answer. I'm not going to say much more than showing you the marginals that come. So what is the price we are paying here? Well, the price we are paying is unsharpness. We do not get as the marginals what Wigner wanted, namely the sharp position of momentum, but what we do get is smearings. These are convolutions of position, the position spectral measure with a probability measure mu, and of the momentum spectral measure with a probability measure mu, and these two measures are related. They are generated by a common quantum state. Now T is interpreted as a quantum state to make sense of these probabilities, if you like to put it that way. To get this convolution structure out of it, we have to space inverse T, but then this works in this way. So, if we want to have something like measurements of phase space points, this is basically our unique answer. And in terms of what we have learned about position and momentum, it says that we only can approximate the position and momentum. What we get is smearings of position and momentum. And I guess Pekka will be telling us more about the associated uncertainty relations that go with this approach. So the message here is really joint measurability. If we stipulate that, we have to buy into unsharpness. Well, this goes further and further, the idea of non-invasive measurability. Here I want to just briefly say we're just really learning as a community between foundations and quantum information. We're just only learning to properly quantify the disturbance versus inaccuracy trade-off. And there are, in recent years, there are more and more papers dealing with this, and there are very different kinds of approaches depending on what measure of approximation is favored and of what measure of disturbance is deemed suitable. And interesting trade-off relations are coming out quite in increasing numbers recently. Here I take a down-to-earth approach, go back to a phase-space measurement model that is based on this coupling operator, unitary coupling operator. I named von Neumann here because he looked at this first bit as an intuitive approximation of a position measurement in his book of 1932 on the very last few pages. He concludes with a calculation where he establishes a formula for the correlation of the pointer observable of the probe particle and the position of the part of the object particle after the measurement. Gives a complicated correlation expression, thereby checking more or less the repeatability properties of that measurement. He could have done a slightly different calculation and would have discovered the POVM at that time. But that had to wait until mathematicians came out with it in the 1940s, and then Ludwig, Davis, Lewis, and others brought it into physics in the 1960s. So von Neumann was so close to overthrow the spectral theory approach right from the beginning. And I think we would have all a very different perspective on quantum mechanics, or the formalism of quantum mechanics, if he had done so. Well, Arthurs and Kelly in 1965 took this, expanded it in this way, and they did not do this calculation. this calculation was in my thesis in 82. But what they verified was that the first moments of the output distributions for the two probe particles coincide with position and momentum, and they were happy, hooray. They found an uncertainty relation for the probability distributions, and they saw the uncertainties get duplicated, so there is unsharpness in this measurement. That was Arthurs and Kelly, and well, I labored on this and found the connection with POVMs. Comes out quite neatly. You just work out the probability distributions, the joint probabilities for the two-pointer observables, and what you get is one of our phase-space observables, just like that. So it's a much more stringent criterion of joint variability than just looking at first moments. It goes all the way to full statistics of a phase-space observable. Here is an expression for the measurement inaccuracies. These smearing functions mu and nu reappear. They are expressed in terms of the preparations of our probe systems. And you see, if I did only one measurement, let's say kappa equal to zero, I would only have one term in the position uncertainty, and I would have an infinity on the momentum uncertainty. I would only have a position measurement. But if both parameters are non-zero, then the uncertainties, the uncertainty of position, the inaccuracy of position gets enlarged by the presence of the second device. So there is always a necessary, inevitable disturbance of the position measurement by the momentum measurement, and the other way around. This would be the undisturbed momentum inaccuracy disturbed by the presence of the position measuring device. Here is the usual formula that defines the measurement transformation on the object, as you all know it. Well, the notation is badly wrong. This should be an x plus y. But that's the instrument acting on the pure input state of the object. These are the tools I need to analyze the question of non-invasive measurability for a classical particle. There are two aspects to the non-disturbance here. The first is that the particle doesn't get disturbed, but that requires that it's in the model, it turns out it requires that it's fairly well localized compared to the inaccuracies. That's a necessary consequence. And that in itself implies, due to the position momentum uncertainty relation for the particle, that the measurement inaccuracies must be macroscopically large, meaning very large compared to, in their product, very large compared to H bar. The second aspect of non-disturbance is the one I indicated already. In order to make these disturbing terms very small, so that the measurements can be said not to disturb each other, again, you have to, it follows that you have to have macroscopically large inaccuracies in both measurements already. So that's the only way you can model a classical particle, by really having macroscopically large inaccuracies built into your measurements. And I have a feeling that that aspect, the measurement aspect, is not sufficiently taken into account in classical limit considerations. So again, the conclusion is that non-disturbance requires macroscopic inaccuracy. I'm tempted to go on for a couple more minutes and rush this. Yeah, this is now here, finally, our definition of objectivity or reality, or my preferred way of looking at it. What about the objective description of macroscopic or classical systems? So, well, there has to be a notion of definite values at the macroscopic level. All observables seem to have definite values all the time, which we can observe without disturbing them. And that's exactly what Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen capture in their definition or criteria. If without in any way disturbing a system, we can predict with certainty, i.e. with probability equal to unity, the value of a physical quantity, then there exists an element of physical reality corresponding to that physical quantity. They point out that they regard this as a sufficient-only condition. They do not claim it to be necessary. I guess from an operational point of view, some of us would agree that one has to take it as a necessary condition for the reality. At least that was my understanding of what Robin was putting to us. So one formal implication of that, expressed in quantum language, is that there has to be an instrument for such classical observables, such that whenever the observable has a certain value, then the state is not changed anymore. In quantum mechanics, this is called the ideality property, and it has a unique solution for projections for sharp observables, which is the Lüders state transformation. But that's bad, because then we are forced to also accept the repeatability of the measurement, which is a very invasive feature of a measurement. Repeatability means really the von Neumann collapse type of transition. We collapse the system into an eigenstate, and that is a rather major disturbance if we don't have already an eigenstate. So there are problems looming here. Therefore, it pays to look ahead and look at what happens if we relax this condition into an approximate reality condition. And in fact, what one gets as a realization is not as rigid a theorem as we have here, but we can have an analogous formula with what I would like to call the generalized Lüders transformation, which has some properties of approximate ideality. So we get almost no, well, small state disturbance if the probabilities are close to one. And certainly we do lose the repeatability. So again, going in the direction of unsharpness, we can decrease the disturbance. But of course, we have to pay the price that we also get less information that way, which goes hand in hand with the fact that inaccuracies have to be macroscopic. Well, what's missing then? Well, for the property of definite values, that requirement rules out lots of states. We cannot allow arbitrary superpositions of localized states without running out of a set of localized states. So classicality really requires the breaking of the superposition principle. At the same time, definite values are only realizable for just a few, well, whatever relevant means, macroscopic observables at one time. And I noted that the values probably will have to be regarded as unsharp. It's certainly the case for phase space observables. So that's what one has to bring in or has to realize comes in, because unsharpness in itself doesn't do the job of giving a quantum description of a classical system. And finally, I'd like to point out a different line of argument which leads to a similar conclusion, and that is again the measurement problem. We have an insolubility theorem which goes back to Wigner, with generalizations by Fine and Shimoni. And it's been shown that this extends to unsharp object as well as pointer observables. So again, unsharpness doesn't pave the way out of that problem either. So here's what we've learned, or hopefully can take away. Understanding the quantum classical contrast and border requires a decision or an interpretational stance. That was the first part of the talk. Quantum probabilistic theories can be presented in only one non-redundant way as a restricted classical theory, the restriction then being that all quantum observables are fuzzy classical observables. The kinematic aspects of a classical system can be approximated in quantum mechanical terms, at least for a particle in terms of phase space observables. But that requires unsharpness. The problem of modeling classical dynamics, I haven't addressed that very much, perhaps only implicitly in terms of measurements being dynamical processes, and there it's shown to go badly wrong or not work well. So thank you for your attention.
Okay, we still have about 10 minutes, so we can spend that in discussions, questions, comments.
I may have just missed this when I left the room for a moment. Is your definition of unsharpness inherently connected with the update rule, with repeatability, or is it independent of that? Because a couple transparencies ago you mentioned it.
Well, I used it here only in an intuitive sense, in the sense that, well, probably was the exclusive sense for decades, because even today you find many papers where the unsharp observables are introduced as smearings, so in relation to other observables which are sharp. So unsharp as not sharp. There is an operational characterization which I didn't bring up here, which goes, well, one example I found recently, which still needs to be explored, but that goes right in the direction of that. So an intrinsic definition of unsharpness, often effect would be something like that. So, well, I give you a measure of the sharpness, and that is W of E is the spectral width of the effect. It's the size of the smallest interval that comprises the spectrum of the effect. W of EE dash is the same thing for the product of E with its complement effect, E dash. That again is an effect. You have, for instance, EE dash is below E and E dash. And you see immediately if E is a projection, that would be zero. That would be zero, and we would be left with that, and that would be just one. Largest eigenvalue being one, the other one being zero, and that's one. So this thing, it turns out, well, this is always between zero and one, and it's one exactly if E is sharp. And it's zero actually exactly when E is of the form a positive multiple times the identity, which I call a trivial effect, other than, well, greater than zero and less than one. So I rule out the 0-1 effect, which are also multiples of the identity. So that's what this measure does. It really measures how close the effect is to being a projection, or how close it is to being trivial. And that is operational in the sense that it can be tested out with measuring probabilities. And you were referring to repeatability, and that comes in this expression. This effect turns up if you make a repeated measurement of E and you compute the probability for obtaining a negative result on the second run, then you look at that effect E dash. So that's related.
So this has an obvious mathematical meaning, but if I want to interpret it operationally, then it's directly connected with repeatability.
Yeah. So unsharpness is quite directly connected with the lack of repeatability.
Yes. What do you mean by non-redundant?
Well, that was this minimalist requirement. I had this mapping which...
No, I mean, not technically, I mean...
Ah.
So what would be a redundant way of doing it?
Well, take a very large omega, which contains sort of more points than I have pure states.
I'm getting something else. Probably you know what I mean. So your notion of non-redundance is probably connected with your notion of fuzziness. So you think by having fuzzy classical observables or unsharp reality, if you like, you are doing something non-redundant.
Well, I probably could put it that way. If I don't require non-redundance, I don't know what the representation looks like. We haven't explored that very much. But at the same time, intuitively, it would mean that one brings more classical observables than and states than one really needs to represent the system. It's a minimalist classical representation of the system.
It's something philosophical. There's nothing to do with technical. The philosophical thing is that you do, I mean, of course you have non-redundancy of one kind, but you have enormous redundancy of philosophical, of metaphysical. So you have this gross redundancy of notion which one has to include. You mentioned potentiality and actuality.
What is redundant about that? That may be a feature of nature.
What is feature of nature is what you observe. What you put in metaphysics into it and say that it's a different modality, which is something in between actuality and logical possibility. A huge can of metaphysical worms.
So say you.
So that's a redundancy of a different kind.
Well, for some of us, that is perhaps the most fascinating feature of quantum mechanics.
I know. Some of my friends say so. That's the problem. Anyway,
I'd take that as a comment.
Yes. I mean, it can't be.
But we will fight further over this.
Yes. If I want to accurately describe my classical experience, how to include errors in my measurements, does this fuzziness capture that, or is there something else missing?
Well, I think that was my point here to bring on. There must be something else, because I can bring in the kinematic aspects, and that requires fuzziness already. But I'm not so sure, no, I'm pretty sure that the dynamic aspects of a classical system displaying definite values of its observables all the time, that is not recovered by that alone. Yeah, that was the point, and one way of framing that up is looking at the measurement problem, but it's an incomplete way of thinking that there must. There's more work to be done to explore that, pinpoint that.
You talked about repeatability on purpose. I'm wondering what's known about operational commutativity implying sharpness. So what I mean by operational commutativity is the notion that it doesn't matter what order you do the two measurements in. So suppose I have two measurements of two POVMs, and I want to ask, when is it the case that the statistics I get for those measurements for any given preparation procedures are independent of the order in which I do the two POVMs? Now, I would guess that that constraint is strong enough to imply that POVMs actually have to be projective and commute. So it implies that they have to commute. So then there's no implication for sharpness there. There's a second notion, maybe also.
Let me correct you on one point. You said repeatability implies sharpness. The logic of my argument was for sharp observables, for projections, the property of reproducibility already implies repeatability. Reproducibility by definition is weaker, as is shown by looking at effects which are not projections. They can have reproducible measurements in an approximate sense without also leading to repeatability in an approximate sense. So, one has to look at the proofs of these things and the precise formulation, but I didn't want to suggest here that, EPR does not stipulate repeatability, but for projections, for sharp measurements, it leads to that anyway.
Perhaps I may recall the old result of Osawa, who saw that repeatability implies always the discreteness.
But not the sharpness.
Not the sharpness, but the discreteness of the measurement.
Okay. That's a global statement. Ah.
No, I think we are just past the time, so let's start on it.